everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 54. I am your host, Charles Lowell. With me is Alex Ford. And today we're going to be interviewing Katie Gangler. I remember very distinctly the first time that I met Katie. It was actually at the same dinner, I think, that I met Godfrey at EmberConf in 2014. And that was just a fantastic conversation that was had around that table. And I did not realize how important the people that I was meeting were going to be in my life over the next couple years. But, you know, Katie has gone on to do things like identify, hey, there's a hole in the Ember add-on ecosystem. And so, you know, she created Ember Observer. There's a huge piece missing from being able to test this framework that, you know, spans multiple years and multiple versions, and being able to make sure that your tests, especially for add-on authors, you know, run against multiple versions. So she created and maintains Ember Try. She's a part of the Ember CLI core team. She's a principal at Code All Day, which is a software consultancy, and just an all-around fantastic woman. So thank you, Katie, for coming on to the show and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the things I wanted to start out the conversation with is, you know, something that's always struck me about you is there's a lot of people who, when it comes to testing, you know, they talk the talk, but you have always struck me as someone who walks the walk, and not just, you know, in terms of you make sure that your apps have tests in them or your add-ins have tests in them, but talking to people about testing patterns, making sure that when there are huge pieces of the ecosystem missing, like Ember Try, that, you know, I remember this is something that I struggled with. You know, I was running up against this problem and, you know, all of a sudden, boom, you know, here comes Ember Try. And like, you know, you've been such a huge part of that. Like, I want to know more about kind of your walk with testing and how you kind of came to have it permeate so much of what you do, because I think it's very important for people to hear that.
I got really lucky right out of college. My first job was at a place that was on one of those mythical, people think are mythical, teams of XP-focused developers. And so the first thing I was told is everything's test first, everything's test driven. And that was primarily doing Ruby and Rails at the time, but also JavaScript. And eventually, at the beginning, we didn't really have a way to test JavaScript. And there was a lot of missteps in the way of testing JavaScript until we came around to QNIT. And so I was using QNIT long before Ember even came along. So it's just kind of been ingrained in my whole career. Michelle as well. Michelle's my partner at Code All Day, and we're both pretty test-focused. I think that's what drew us to starting a company together and working together. So every project we're on, we try to write encompassing tests. So test drive everything. If we're on a project to upgrade or on a project to fix a bug, we try to write tests to as a framework for everything that we're doing, so we know whether we're doing something right or not. And when it comes to Ember Try, that wasn't entirely my own idea. That was something that Robert Jackson and Edward Faulkner were looking for somebody to write. And I had remembered the appraisals gem from Ruby. And so I really enjoyed being able to do that with gems that I had written in Rails. And so I wanted it to exist for Ember. And so I just kind of took it upon myself to do it. And it was extracted from Liquid Fire, had some scripts that would sort of test multiple versions, but it was rough. It wasn't as easy as it is today.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does speak to a certain philosophy because, I mean, if you're coming to a problem and it's difficult to test, you often come to a crossroads where you say, you know what, I have a choice to make here. I can either give up, I can, you know, not write a test or write, you know, try and test some subset of it, or I can write the thing that will let me write the test. And it seems like, you know, you fall more into that second category. And so what would you say to people who are kind of either, you know, new to this idea or new in their careers and they butt up against this problem of not knowing when to give up and when to write the thing, to write the test?
I almost never don't write a test. So like your suspicions are true. I will write something to be able to write the test. But there are times I'm a pragmatist. There are times I'm just like, this is not going to be tested. This is not going to happen. So finding that line is pretty hard, but it should be extremely rare. It's not when people come to me or where I work with a client and they're telling me, no, it's too hard to write the tests. I think it's a lot of times it's not only how you have the test and writing the test and learning about how to write the test. It's the code you're trying to test that could be the problem. And so if you have very complicated code, very side effect driven code, it's very hard to write the easier style of tests, which might be Ember acceptance tests or which are really kind of on the level of integration because you do have a little bit of knowledge of what's going on and you have to be within the framework of what Ember's tests are. want you to do, which is async is all completed by the time you want to have this assertions in the test. And so maybe then you need to look at different tools, like going back to something like Capybara or Selenium and have some sort of tests around what you're doing in order to replace the code that makes it hard to test it at a lower level to begin with. And so I think a lot of people are just missing the framework for knowing what to do when their code is intractable, not necessarily that the testing and the guides to how to do tests are fine. I think most people could go through a tutorial and do tests for a little to-do MVC app perfectly fine. But that's easy when you know both sides of the equation. And so if you're already struggling with code and you're not quite sure what you're doing with Ember, it can seem very, very hard to write tests for that. And I think that's true with Rails as well. I think people beginning with Rails, they don't understand what they're doing with testing, especially if they have an existing app they're trying to add tests to. But unfortunately, Rails long ago kind of got into everybody's heads that tests go with what you're doing. It's just ingrained part of the Rails community. Hopefully that's become how it is with Ember, but a lot of people are kind of slowly bringing their apps to Ember, and so they already have a lot of JavaScript and they don't necessarily know what to do, or they're writing JavaScript how they always have written it with jQuery and a little bit of spaghetti, and they don't understand how to test that.
And so how does Ember Try help with that? I actually want to roll back and talk about what is Ember Try and how does it fit into testing. You mentioned the appraisal gem, which I'm not familiar with. I haven't done much Rails in my life or Ruby, but can we talk about what Ember Try is?
Sure. Ember Try lets you run different, lets you run different scenarios with your tests. At some point, I would have said that lets you run different scenarios of dependencies for your tests, and so primarily changing your Ember version. And that's pretty much what add-ons do, but a lot of people are using it for scenarios that are completely outside of dependencies. So different environment variables, different browsers. They're just having one place to have all these scenarios, whereas if you just put it in your Travis.yaml, so like your CI configuration, you wouldn't as easily be able to run that locally. But with Ember Try, you can do that locally. And so I found that it's kind of, beyond my intentions, expanded beyond dependencies. So primarily, it lets you run your test in your application with different configurations. I could see running it with different feature flags would be something that would be interesting to do if that's something you use. And so primarily it just lets you try different versions. Appraisals gem let you run tests with different gem sets. And so you'd have a different gem file for each scenario you possibly had. And so that was definitely dependency focused.
That sounds really cool. It almost sounds like you could even get into some sort of, you know, generative testing where you're kind of not specifying the scenarios up front, but having, you know, some sort of mechanism to generate those scenarios so you can try and surface bugs that would only occur outside of what you're explicitly testing for, like just kind of randomly choosing different versions of environment variables, feature flags, dependencies, and stuff like that. Have you given any thought to that?
Randomization would be cool, but Ember Try already does have a kind of generative way of working. I don't know if that's what you're alluding to, but if you wanted to, especially for add-ons, you can specify this version compatibility keyword in your package.json and give Ember and give a sender string of versions, and it will generate the scenarios for you and test all of those versions. And so the sender strings are pretty powerful. So you can do ORs, you can say specifically the versions you want, you can do a range of versions, and it'll take the latest patch release of every minor release. We didn't want to be too crazy and test each of those for that add-on. But yeah, I can definitely see something being random be really cool.
Yeah.
Some testing thing that's like that. What is it? Just tries to do random input into all of your inputs on a page. I've really been meaning to try that out. Sounds like it would find some fun stuff.
Yeah. Just to like try and break it. Yeah. No, I remember a world before Ember Try, and it really, I can't speak highly enough about it and the fact that how many bugs it has caught in the add-ons that we maintain, you know, because you're always working on the latest, hottest, greatest version of Ember, and you're not thinking, well, what about 2-point releases back? And there might be, you know, not a deal breaker, but some subtle bug that, you know, that surfaces and breaks your tests. And like, you know, the coverage has just gotten so much better. And the fact I think that this is so brilliant is that it's bundled with Ember CLI when you are building an add-on. It's like, you, now you get it for free. It's just, yeah, it's one of those things where it's hard to imagine what it was like, even though, you know, we lived it.
And it was less than a year ago. Well, Ember Try has existed for longer, but being bundled with Ember CLI is only since last EmberConf or so.
Yeah, but I mean, it's absolutely a critical piece of the infrastructure now.
I'm glad it's caught a lot of bugs for you. I don't think I've actually caught a bug with it ever.
Really?
Yeah, but I don't do a lot of I don't do a lot of Ember add-ons. I do a lot of Ember CLI-ish add-ons, so.
Right.
It can't change versions of Ember CLI because it Not yet. We're working on that. I get some weird NPM errors when I do that, when I've tried it, but I haven't dug into it much yet.
Yeah, no, I remember I don't want to dig too much into the mechanics, but even when I first heard about it, I was like, how does that even work? Like just, replacing all the dependencies and having a separate node modules directory and Bower and there's so many moving parts. You know, it was one of those things where it's so ambitious. I didn't even think it was possible I didn't even think about writing it myself or whatever. It's one of those, wow. Okay. It can be done.
This exists now.
Yeah.
Add-on authors are accountable now for making their add-ons, right? Work with revisions or versions a few points back, like you said. But it makes it so easy. Like, the accountability is hardly accountability. It's running Ember Try. It's really amazing.
So what I'm laughing about is that what it actually does is not very sophisticated or crazy at all. So for instance, for Bower, it moves your existing Bower components directory to a placeholder, changes the bower.json, runs install, and then after the scenario, puts everything back.
Right. But I don't know. It sounds hard. It's intimidating. You've got all this state and you got to make sure you put it all back. And what do you do if you abort midway? And I'm sure you've had to think about and deal with all that stuff at some point.
I kill my tests all the time in Ember Try. I was like, oops. Forgot I shouldn't do that. Just let it finish.
Yeah, it doesn't recover so well. It's pretty hard to do things on process exit in Node correctly, at least, and I don't think I've gotten it quite right. But there is a cleanup command. Unfortunately, with the way it interacts with Ember CLI's dependency checker, so when you run an Ember command, Ember checks to make sure all of your dependencies are installed. So if you still have the different bower.json and install hadn't run, you'll have to run install before you can run the cleanup command, which is kind of a drag.
I have one final question about Ember Try. Have you given any thought to how this might be extracted and more generally applicable to the greater JavaScript ecosystem? Because I see this as something that while Ember certainly was a trailblazer in this area, I mean, it's certainly, as we saw, some of these ideas came from Rails and other places. You know, this is going to be more generally applicable. And have you given thought to extracting that?
Yeah, it's been one of my thoughts since we first did it, because we realized very early on that it could be completely, it doesn't depend on Ember CLI at all, really, other than using it as a command line arguments parser, which doesn't seem too important. But there are some assumptions we get to make for it being in an Ember app. We know how Ember CLI apps are structured. And so some of those assumptions I wouldn't really know with the greater Node community, and I actually, those assumptions might not be possible at all, because they don't have the standards we have with Ember CLI. You generate an Ember CLI app. There's generally certain things that are in place, and Ember test works for sure. And so there's definitely part of it that could be extracted, but I'd worry about some assumptions about node modules always being in the directory that you're in, because you can actually, with NPM, you can link a node modules above it, and the Ember CLI explicitly doesn't support that, but other places obviously have to. And so it could definitely happen, but I'm not so sure that I'd want to personally support that, because it is a big time commitment.
Right. So maybe if someone from the outside wanted to step in and volunteer, you might work with it, but not to personally champion that cause.
Definitely. I think it would be really cool. And I do think it'll end up having its own command line architecture eventually, just to be able to do things like different Ember CLI versions. Because then as long as it's not part of Ember CLI, I think that'll be less confusing, though. In theory, that can be done within Ember CLI still, but I'm not clear on that. I've had people talk to me about that, and I haven't fully processed it yet.
Right. Alex, you mentioned something earlier I had not thought about, but I really like. That was that, technologies like Ember Try keep the add-on community accountable and keep them healthy by making sure that add-ons are working across a multiplicity of Ember versions and working in conjunction with other add-ons that might have version ranges. And Katie, you've been, a critical part of that effort. But there's also something else that you've been a critical part of that you built, you know, from the ground up, and that is Ember Observer. And, you know, that is a different way of keeping add-ons accountable. But I think that, you know, perhaps even in a more valuable way, like a more of a social engineering way, and that's through the creation of Ember Observer. Maybe we could talk about Ember Observer a little bit, what it is and kind of what gave you the insight that this is something that needs to be built. And so I'm going to step forward and I'm going to build it.
So I'm definitely going to refer again back to the Rails community. So I'm a big fan of Ruby Toolbox. And so whenever I needed a gem, I would go there and try to see what was available in that category and kind of weigh all those variables it would have on there. It would have some things like the popularity and the number of GitHub stars and the last time it was updated. So you can see a lot of the inspiration for our Ember Observer comes from there. So maybe I should step back and explain Ember Observer. Ember Observer is a listing of all of the add-ons for the Ember community. Anything that has the Ember add-on keyword will show up there. We pull it all from NPM. And it'll show you all that kind of information, the last updated, the number of GitHub commits, the number of stars, the number of contributors. And we put all that information and a manual review together to put a score on each add-on. And so you can look at it, and we categorize them as well. So if you look in a category, say you were looking at a category for doing modals, you would see all of the different modal add-ons and be able to look between them and compare them and decide which one to use. Or if you're thinking of building something, you can go there and be like, oh, this already exists. Maybe I should just contribute to an existing thing. And so that said, what gave me the idea for it is that I was looking at Ember add-ons.com, which just shows you the most recently published add-ons for the Ember add-on keyword every day. And every time I was clicking on these add-ons, I would go, well, there was one just the other day that did the same thing. And it just seemed like such a waste to me that people were creating the same things. And then there's some add-ons you'd click into, and it was like, why did I bother clicking into this? It doesn't have anything. Like, it's just an empty add-on. People are pushing add-ons just to try that out. And so I thought it'd be nice if something filtered that out. And I happened to have some time, so I got started, and I dragged my husband Phil into it. He's also an Ember and Rails developer, so that's pretty convenient. And my friend Lou. And now Michelle works on it quite a bit as well. And so that's what drove us to build it, and it's been pretty cool. I don't know, I like looking at all the add-ons when they come out anyway, so I feel like it's not any extra work for me. It's quicker than my email each day to look at the new add-ons.
How many new add-ons are published every day, on average?
On average, it's probably 4 to 6 maybe, but it varies widely. If you get like a holiday, you'll get like 20 new add-ons. People have time off. But then you get some weeks that you know, some week when you're just feeling the grind too, and you'll notice that the add-ons drop commensurately too. Everybody else is having the same kind of week.
You mentioned that an add-on gets a score. Can you explain that score and how you rate add-ons?
Sure. So the score is mostly driven by details about the add-on. So there's a number of factors that go into it, and it's out of 10 total points. And so 5 of them are from purely mechanical things. So whether or not there's been more than 2 Git commits in the last 3 months, whether or not there's been a release in the last 3 months. What else is there? Let's see. So whether or not they're in the top 10% of add-ons, top 10% of NPM downloads for add-ons, whether they're in the top 10% of GitHub stars for add-ons.
I know that I'm a very competitive person. That also applies to like software, not just sports or other types of competition. But I remember a moment, and I'm an add-on author, when my add-on had a 9 out of 10, and I was just about to push some code and just about to get a release. And then like even before that happened, it went to a 10. And I don't know, the amount of satisfaction I got out of that is kind of ridiculous. but I like it. I like the scoring system, not just for myself, but also for helping me discover add-ons and picking the ones that might be right for me. I'll check out any add-on basically that might fit the description. As long as it has a README, I'll go check it out. But it still helps along with the categorization.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you can achieve an 8 out of 10 without it being a popularity contest. You know, you can by saying there's certain concrete steps that you can take to make sure that you have tests and that you have a README that's, you know, a thing of substance. And I don't remember what all the criteria are, but you can get a high score, you know, without getting into the how many stars or how many if you're in the top 10%. And so I think that's awesome. But it does mean that if I see an add-on with like a 5, or something like that, then it means that they're not taking like concrete steps, or it might not be as well maintained. And so, you know, that's definitely something to take into account. I'm curious if there are any like different parameters you've thought, tweaks you've thought of making to the system, or, you know, this is, I guess the second part of that is, you know, what things had you considered that you threw out, you know, out of hand as maybe not good ways to rate add-ons?
Yeah, we've thought about a number of things. I don't particularly like the popularity aspect of it, but I did feel necessary to include it in some way. So the stars, in theory, are representative of interest, not as much as popularity, but it probably gets into popularity as well. And then downloads, in theory, are for popularity. But the problem with downloads, and I found this, it's happening more and more frequently, is that if large companies start publishing their own add-ons and they have a lot of developers, they are going through the roof on those downloads, and so they're getting that point just from their own developers, and I have no way of knowing if anybody else is using this.
Probably they're continuous integration containers, right? Like, if it's just running on Travis or Circle, it's just, you know, sitting there spinning, like, pumping the download numbers.
Yeah, and that frustrates me quite a bit. But I haven't found another thing that can be representative of popularity. Unfortunately, with NPM, you can get the download counts, but you can't tell where they came from. So there's no way to do that. And there's some things that, you know, some people would like to see the things that are more popular, you know, rate higher than they currently do. Like you said, 8 out of 10 points go without the popularity coming into effect. But you do need the collaboration of at least one other person to get 8 points. You can only get 7 by yourself. You need to have another contributor. So if you only have one contributor, you don't get that point, because it's trying to be representative of whether or not the, you know, sort of a bus factor, but it's not truly there. I mean, you could just have one commit from somebody else and you'll get that.
I think I you know, of all the pieces, I think that's totally fair.
Yeah, there's definitely a few other things I have in mind to bring into the metrics, but we're not quite there yet. I need to entirely refactor how the score is given so that it's not exactly out of 10, because the idea is to have some questions and some points that are relevant only to certain categories of add-ons. And so whether or not an add-on is testing against different versions of Ember might not matter if the add-on is only adding to Ember CLI. Or whether or not they've had a recent release might not matter if it's kind of a one-off, you know, maybe a SaaS plugin or something more of a build tool that doesn't change very frequently.
Yeah, I've noticed, you know, we have that happen a couple of times where we've got a component that just wraps a type of input. And, you know, until the HTML spec changes or a major API changes happens in Ember, there's no need to change it. So, yeah, I can definitely see that. How do you mark it as like something that changes infrequently? Is it just if the add-on author says it's done, you give them a bigger window or something like that? Or
there'll probably be some sort of categories that fall under that. For like an input, I think if it's doing something that adds to Ember, if it's using components, you probably want to be upgrading Ember CLI at least every 3 months. So I think in that case, it's probably fair to require an update within that period of time. But some of the things that are closer to more close to Broccoli plugins than they are to Ember add-ons may make sense to not have that requirement. And maybe not that's, maybe that's not the exact example of the kind of questions that'll vary, but.
Yeah.
You know, an Ember add-on was the first time that I gave back to the open source community. It was my first open source project. And Ember Observer really helped me along the way to say, what is an open source best practice? And I thought that was really cool. And now it sounds like with some of the point totals, you're leaning towards Ember best practices to help Ember add-on authors along that way. And I think that's really awesome and very, very useful. I would not like to see what the Ember add-on ecosystem would look like without Katie. It would be a very different place.
Thanks. I'm glad it's had some help on that and on affecting add-on authors. I actually didn't originally think of that when I was first building it. I was really hoping to help consuming of add-ons, but it really has kind of driven out people finding add-ons to not build because they can contribute to existing ones, and also driving them for the score. Because as you said, people get very competitive. I really didn't realize what kind of drive the score would be. Because to me, I'm like, somebody else is scoring me. How dare you? I have had people say that to me. How dare you score me? How dare you score my add-on? I was like, well, it's mostly computerized. Even the review is manual, but the only thing about it has any sort of leeway is, are there meaningful tests? So that's really the only thing when I go through an add-on is, whether or not that has any sort of leeway for the judgment of the person that's doing the reading. Because is there a readme? That goes kind of, we have kind of a rubric. So that goes if you have anything in there that's other than that default Ember add-on readme. And whether or not there's a build, that's based entirely whether or not there's a CI tag in the readme, because it would be too onerous to go look for them otherwise. Hoping to automate that so I don't have to keep looking for those. But a lot of add-ons turned out to have builds when they didn't have any meaningful tests. They just had linked tests, and so that's kind of confusing.
So wait, what do you do in that situation? You actually manually review it so that you would actually, that add-on would not get the point for tests.
No, they don't get the point for tests. And if they don't get the point for tests, I put NA for whether or not they have a build. So it doesn't apply.
Okay.
It doesn't mean anything to me if they have a build and they don't
have
tests.
Right, right, right. No, that makes sense. So a lot of it is automated, but it still does, sounds like, you know, consume some of your time, some of Phil's time, some of Michelle's time. And so I guess my question is, do you accept donations or, you know, a way that people can contribute? Because, you know, I see this as kind of part of the critical infrastructure of the community at this point. And so there might be some people out there who think, gosh, maybe I could help in some way. Is there a way that people can help? And if so, I'd love to hear about it.
We don't have any sort of donation button or anything like that. Maybe we should. We consider it primarily just part of our open source works, part of our contributing to the community, because we also make a great deal of use out of the community. And fortunately, it's not very expensive to run. It's on a $20 a month VPS. So other than time, it's not really consuming very many resources, fortunately. That may change over time. I mean, the number of hits is increasing. And we're doing some more resource-intensive things like code search. And we have we are running Ember Try scenarios for the top 100 add-ons to generate compatibility tables. Yeah, it hasn't been the most reliable. Think about if you're trying to do NPM install times 100 add-ons times every day.
Right.
Times a different number of dependency sets. So it's been very much like a game of whack-a-mole. But for now, it's not bad. But yeah, but we probably should think about some sort of donation button and maybe something that writes out the exact numerical costs of something like Ember Preserver. The API is getting about 130,000 hits a month.
Wow.
But that's the API, so that's then some number of quests per person. So Google Analytics tells me something like about 12,000 visitors each month.
So wait, so Ember Observer has an API? So are there any third-party apps that you know about that people have built on top of Ember Observer?
None that have been kind of public. I know a couple of private companies seem to be hitting the API, but it's not a public API. It's really not public yet. I'm in the process of switching it over to JSON API, and at some point I'll make some portion of that a public API, but it's pretty hard to support that and at the same time change Ember Observer pretty frequently and do any kind of migrations we need to do. Ember add-ons does pull the scores from us from one API endpoint.
So I actually wasn't aware. I remember the announcement of code search, but you know, how do you kind of see the usage of that? Like, what's the primary use case of when you would use code search on Ember add-on or Ember observers?
I think the primary use case is if you're looking for how to use a feature, and so if you're creating an add-on and you want to know how to use certain hooks, like, you know, Tree4 or something like that, you can do the code search for that and see what other add-ons are doing. And it's only searching Ember add-ons that have the repository URL set. So you're only going to find Ember results. And so that'll be nicer compared to searching GitHub. And then I find the other use case is more by the core team to see who's using what APIs and whether or not they can deprecate something or change something or if something has become widely used. And I think they seem to be pretty excited about that possibility, or they've already been searching.
That is brilliant.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. The other question that I had was this: running Ember Try scenarios on the top 100 add-ons. So that's something that you're doing now. Are you actually reflecting that in the Ember Observer interface? Like, so is that information, or is that an experimental feature, or is that actually, you know, is that reflected all the way through? So that if I go to Ember Observer today, you know, I'll see that information based on those computations.
It's definitely in the Ember Observer interface. It's only for the top 100 add-ons currently, but hopefully expanding that to all add-ons. It's been there for a few months, but maybe it's not easy to notice. Only on the top 100 add-ons, it'll be in the right sidebar, and there's a list of the scenarios we ran it with and whether or not it passed or not. And so there's that information there. The top 100 are linked to right on the main page of Ember Observer, so they should be easy to find.
So how do you get that information back to the author of that top add-on?
We haven't actually done that. It's just on Ember Observer. And so it's more meant for consumers to see and be like, see and be able to see that this add-on is compatible with all these versions. We're not using their scenarios. We're using our own scenarios saying Ember from this version to this version, unless they have specified that version compatibility thing, and then we'll use that, those auto-generated scenarios. This might get harder as it's harder for add-ons that have complex scenarios and so need something else varied along with the versions, like Ember Data, or maybe they're using Liquid Fire, and so Liquid Fire needs to be a different version for each version's being used. And so for those, we'll just have a thing saying, we're sorry, we're unable to test this. But hopefully this is still providing some useful information for some add-ons. A lot of add-ons, their build won't run unless they commit. So in this case, this is running every night, and so a new Ember version is released. We'll see if that fails. And so on the other side of it, we have a dashboard where we can see which add-ons failed and maybe see if a new commit to something broke a bunch of add-ons. A commit to something like Ember, Ember CLI, Ember Data, you know, one of the main things.
And I know that certainly, like, right after we get out of this podcast, I'm going and running over and checking all the add-ons that we maintain and making sure everything is copacetic. So if you guys see me take off my headphones and, like, dash out the door, you know where I'm going.
Gotcha.
I just have a further comment that I'm excited for the public API of Ember Observer, just because I've been thinking a lot about data visualization lately. And I think it'd be a really cool tool to do like a deprecated API, like one of those bubble charts where like the area that's covered by this deprecated API. So I'm doing a bad job of explaining this, just like the most used deprecated API methods and visualizing that. I think that would be really interesting to see it.
Right. Seeing how they spread across the add-on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or just all add-ons in general.
I am most nervous about a public API for code search, though, because it is a little bit resource intensive. So just freaking out a little bit about the potential of a public API for it. But the Ember Observer client is open source, so if anybody wants to add anything to the app, that I consider as public, thank goodness.
Nice.
Adding to that, I really do want to figure out some way to have kind of like a performance budget for when people add to the client. Because sometimes I'll get people who want to add features and I'm like, well, that's just going to screw all of them. Pardon my language. It's going to be a problem for all of Ember Observer. It's going to make everything slower. And it's already a little slow, but JSON API, fortunately, I have kind of a beta version of it running, and it's going to be much faster, thank God. I guess I probably shouldn't say that either.
Definitely want to get that donation button set up before the API goes public. Okay, so let's turn to the internet now, and we'll answer some of the questions that got tweeted in. So we got a question from Jonathan Jackson, and he wanted to ask you, so where have you seen the most change in the Ember ecosystem since last EmberConf, which was March of 2016?
So there's definitely fewer add-ons being published, but the add-ons that are being published are kind of for, I'm going to say, more grown-up things. So we've got, I don't know if Engines was before or after March. I have no idea. Time is one of those things that Engines, and then people doing things related to fast food. And so things are more coming from more collaborative efforts, I think. This is just my gut feeling. I have no data on this. This is my gut feeling from looking at add-ons. And then there's a lot of add-ons that are coming out that are specific to a particular company. And so I think that might be, maybe, I hope, representative of more companies getting into Ember, but hopefully they'll make things more generic and share them back. And so, yeah, the problem with the popularity I spoke about before, where a big company is getting itself into the top 100 list, probably with just its own employees, only appeared over the summer. And I tried a few different ways to mutate the algorithm to try to get them out of there, but there was no solution there. Yeah, it's less novel, much fewer novel things. Very rarely do I look at Ember add-ons and be like, ooh, that's great. But when I do, it's something very exciting.
Right. So there's a level of maturity, it sounds like, we're starting to see. And then I actually think there is something in the story, too, of, you know, there are now larger companies with big code bases that have lots of fan out on their dependency tree that just weren't there before.
Definitely. I mean, I think some of the large companies were there before, but I think some of the largest companies are probably keeping most of their add-ons private. So there's kind of this mid-range of company that's big enough to dominate things or willing enough to put things open source. A few of these companies that can have a lot of add-ons now, and some of them are, a lot of the add-ons are very similar to things that already existed. So you're looking at it, you might be like, I don't know why I use this, but they've obviously made changes for some reason.
The other thing that I wanted to talk to you about before we wrap up is you actually are, you know, in partnership in Code All Day. What kind of business is that? What is it that you guys do? And what's it like running your company while at the same time you're kind of managing these large pieces of the Ember ecosystem?
It's definitely, so Code All Day is a small, very small, it's just me and Michelle, a consulting company. We kind of partnered together after we left a startup and decided to do consulting together. And we primarily do Ember projects, also some Rails, and we try to work together. We do a lot of test-driven things. It's pretty kind of loose, and so there aren't a lot of demands of running it since it's just a partnership. We don't have any employees. But so Ember Observer and stuff will take up a lot of our time, and we really had an idea that it might help us get clients that way, though. So I suppose it's kind of helps our credibility, but it hasn't really been great for leads so much. But fortunately, that hasn't been a big problem for us. So we enjoy spending our time on that. We enjoy the flexibility that consulting gives us, and a lot of that flexibility is what's going into making these things keep running.
Alrighty. Well, are there any kind of skunk work, stealth, secret, like things you've got like brewing in the lab, crazy ideas that you might be ready to give a sneak preview about for inquiring minds who may want to know?
Some of it I've already alluded to, which is redoing Ember Observer with JSON API instead of currently it's using Active Model Serializers, which is a kind of custom API to Rails. And Active Model Serializers supports JSON API now, though we're moving to something called JSON API Resources. And so that'll get the performance of Ember Observer much better. And that's pretty much my primary focus at the moment. I don't really have any big skunk works. Exciting projects. I have far off ideas that hopefully will materialize into some sort of skunk works projects.
All right. Well, fantastic. I want to say, you know, thank you, Katie, for coming on the show. I know that you are kind of like a hero of mine in the sense that, you know, I think a lot of people come to a community and they see like, oh, you know, where's the value in being a member of this community in terms of the things that I can take out of it? What does it provide for me? And you demonstrate on a day-to-day basis, you know, asking what you can do for your community rather than what your community can do for you, to paraphrase JFK. And, you know, I think you live that every day. And so I look up to you very much in that. And so thank you for being such a stalwart of the community in which I'm a part of. And thank you for coming on the show.
I'm very happy to have been here. And thank you. I mean, I use a lot of you guys' add-ons, and it's really the community has given so much to me, which is why I ever want to participate in it. It's really a great group of people.
Yep. Alrighty. Well, bye, everybody.
Bye.